This week on Making Contact.
We're willing to be outrageous. We're willing to stand at the halls of power and say, no, it doesn't have to be this way. We're not going to stand for it to be this way.
We are unreasonable in the face of horrible unreasonableness, where being unreasonable is the only reasonable answer.
From civil rights to environmental justice, genuine progress means redefining what society accepts as reasonable. On this edition, we'll hear stories of four women struggling for a cleaner environment and more peaceful society. In their view, these unreasonable times merit unreasonable actions. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Diane Wilson has been called the godmother of the movement known as Unreasonable Women for the Earth. She's a fourth-generation fisher from the Texas Gulf Coast and a mother of five. Several years ago, Diane discovered that the county she lived in was the most polluted in the United States. Without any formal training or experience, she started a nonprofit and began organizing against multinational chemical companies in Calhoun County. In 1995, Diane conducted three hunger strikes that forced two companies, Formosa Plastics and Alcoa Aluminum, to stop discharging pollutants into the nearby Gulf of Mexico. Diane has received numerous awards for her efforts. She spoke at the Bioneers Conference in 2003 about some of her victories in the fight for environmental justice.
I am here for one purpose only, and that is to tell all of you women sitting out there that you can do an unreasonable action. I mean, right now, like tomorrow morning sometime, you can start it, because you don't have to, you know, because I know a lot that stops people from actions is you got this linear, left brain side that automatically it starts getting into the saying, well, we got to have a plan, and we got to have a board, and we got to have funding, and we got to get a committee together to discuss that. And then, you know, and by the second day, you're fighting, and it's out the window. And besides that, if you even start thinking of an action, but you sleep on it, and you work it over in your mind, in your rational mind, and you're going to stop that action dead. And so my experience has told me is that you don't need people. You don't need money. It's all a myth, you know, and it's not just me, a little woman from Seadrift saying this. Gandhi said this. It's a myth that is required, because all it needs is one person stepping out and committing themselves. I am a very small town. My whole community is 1,000 people, and it's been that way for 50 some odd years. I've been there 50 some odd years. I got four generations of fishing families there. So I wanted to tell you that people can instigate actions, and there is something about, and I believe it is like a key to the universe, there's something about the level of commitment and the risk and the faith that you have. When I first started out on my, all I did was call a meeting. That's all I did. You know, because I started out, I didn't have any training in the environmental movement. I didn't know where the EPA office was. I didn't even know what the EPA stood for. I didn't know what the chemical companies were. I hated chemistry. I didn't know what permits were. I didn't like talking with people. And here I was fixing to just call me a little meeting. And there was such an immediate backlash from a simple meeting that it was my curiosity that got the better of me, because I was like, what are they upset about? And the thing it is, the more you get involved in it, it is like a snowball effect. And so the reason why I got unreasonable is because you cannot talk, especially down in my neck of the woods, is there's wasn't a single politician that would even talk to me. I mean, I went to the most liberal politician I could find. He even had Martin Luther King pictures on his wall. He had pictures of Cesar Chavez up there, and I asked him to just mention the word environment, and he said, you're known as a maverick, and I'm not fixing to commit political suicide, but even bringing up those types of things. But I just wanted to tell you about three different things that I have unreasonable. And the thing that is, I truly believe y'all can figure out a lot more unreasonable actions than this, because there's, I believe you can be extremely creative. And the first one I did was when I found out that this $2 billion chemical company, the worst, that, matter of fact, they'd been kicked out of Taiwan. They were so bad. And the people kicked them out. They got kicked out of Taiwan, so they came to Texas and my little community down there. And the EPA was going to give them their permits. State was going to give them the permits. The governor was involved. Phil Graham, senators. Everybody was taking a bow for this. And it was like, you know, it was bought. It's a done deal. In Texas, we got a lot of done deals. And I was like, they're just not going to do it. And they said, well, there's nothing you can do, Diane. You know, you've done this and you've done that. And just, you know, just be reasonable and know that you've done everything that you could do. And it was like, they're not getting it. And so the only thing I could think of off the top of my head was I would do a hunger strike. And it was like, I didn't know the first thing about a hunger strike. I had never did one. I didn't know anybody that had did one. And they was like, you can't do a hunger strike. And I was like, well, I'm going to do a hunger strike. And they said, women especially don't do hunger strikes. I was like, well, I'm going to do a hunger strike. And the thing of it was, is I knew myself well enough that if I didn't start it that day, but if I slept on that night, I was going to say, oh, Lord, God, don't let me do this hunger strike. No. And so I called a reporter up and said I was starting a hunger strike right then. And that action so frustrated the entire process that was going on. I was on it for 2 weeks, and I got exactly what I wanted. Okay. And the other action I wanted to tell you, another spontaneous, unreasonable action, is I was with, this was like last year, and I had just been to the Unreasonable Women for the Earth, the retreat, and I had first met Medea Benjamin. It was the first time I'd ever met her. And she was like, said, well, you just got to come to Washington with me. And I'm like, well, okay, you know. And so I went to Washington with her, and we had no idea what we were going to do. You know, and we were like, you know, well, what should we do? And I was like, well, I don't know. Well, you know, what's going on there? You know, I mean, this is like the day before the action. And we found out that Donald Rumsfeld was going to speak about the war in Iraq in front of the Service Arms Committee. And it was like, well, we could go to that, and we could just kind of show up here. We didn't have a banner. We didn't have a way of getting in. And so that night, we went to a little grocery store. I mean, not a grocery store, but a little, you know, kind of like a Walmart things, got some sheets, and we made banners probably about 11 o'clock that night, and they were almost still wet, and we folded them up, and the next morning, they only allowed like 15 people into the Service Arms Committee when Rumsfeld got up with all the brass and all the senators and all that thing, and so we got in line. We were the first ones there. We were there at 7 o'clock in the morning. We're just sitting there waiting, you know, and it was, and this is what I'm telling you about serendipity. It's like you put yourself out there. And so they brought in all the congresspeople. They brought in Rumsfeld. They brought in the press. They brought in everybody except the people they were going to let in. And we had the security police come wave to me and Medea and said, you just come sit right here. And they stuck us right behind Rumsfeld. See? You know. Universe is on our side there. So anyway, I just want you to know that just being unreasonable and spontaneous and trust your gut instinct and be outrageous.
That was Diane Wilson, environmental activist from Texas. Continuing Diane's story is Jody Evans, an organizer and activist who worked for former California Governor Jerry Brown and later ran his presidential campaign. Jody now works with a number of progressive groups, including the Rainforest Action Network and Code Pink, a grassroots women's peace and social justice movement formed in 2002 to oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
I'm going to follow up the story that Diane started. I mean, what she didn't say is that they sat behind Rumsfeld, and the first image ever that really spoke against the invasion was Medea and Diane behind Rumsfeld with that banner. And I don't think you get that. It's like they were there all alone. Two women went to Washington. So I want to continue that story. About a month later, we all found ourselves in Washington again after a globalization action. And this time there were, instead of two women, I think there were five women in the living room or six women in the living room. It was the day that Bush was bringing the Congress, the next day Bush was bringing Congress to the Rose Garden to talk about his resolution, his resolution, not the one they'd presented to him. And it was sitting there and saying, okay, what do we do tomorrow? And we found out about the Rose Garden, so Diane started with sheets again, out in the back patio, painting No War in Iraq. And we started making little doves of peace to put on our breasts, on our bras, to say, you know, no war in Iraq. And we heard about a hearing the next day. We said, okay, we'll meet at 8 o'clock in the morning outside the White House. You'll know where to meet because it'll be where everyone else is. It was only us again. I want to also say that Diane that day climbed up the post of the White House to hang the big banner that she'd made. And while she was on top of the post, you know, the security was going crazy, the media was covering it, they were, you know, she wasn't going to come down because she knew that up there she was telling the story, that if she stayed there. And you know, it ran on the media for about an hour that morning until they figured out she wasn't a terrorist, she was an anti-war activist. Yeah. Then it wasn't news anymore. First of all, it was pouring rain, it was freezing cold, and you can't have a sign bigger than 2x4. You can't spend the night in the park across from the White House. You can't lie down. You can't sit down. There can't be more than 25 of you gathered together at once. I mean, that vision just, you know, kept getting smaller and smaller. But Diane wasn't going to let that stop her. So she continued to fast and sleep outside in the park until they arrested her Thanksgiving Eve and sent her home and said, "Don't you come back here again." And so she's literally kicked out of Washington for a year. And if she comes back, she's put in jail for a year. Those actions have continued. Women came from around the country. They sat in the vigil. It was the coldest winter in like 80 years. The community that came together, what it's like when women and men come together and bring what their truth is. Because Code Pink is a call. It's not an organization. It's a call for women to stand up, speak out, and be visible for the world you want to live in. And so that call has touched people around the country. I mean, we don't even know what happened. Sometimes I Google to Code Pink just to see what's happening out there. I remember one day there was an action in like Santa Cruz, there was one in Seattle, there was one in Colorado, all in one day that we had no idea. It's just people who've taken the Code Pink and said, we're willing to be outrageous, we're willing to stand at the halls of power and say, no, it doesn't have to be this way, we're not gonna stand for it to be this way. And so it's just infected all over, not only in America, but around the world. I mean, Alerta Rosa and the women in so many countries that have taken it and used it for what they need to do. I want to talk about the community that comes out of this and what it was like to create the march and rally in Washington on International Women's Day for 10,000 women and what that felt like to create, what it felt like when women showed up. I mean, you always had something to eat. And you had amazing men allies that showed up with their skills to support you or just walk in the door and say, what can I do? That just showed up and they knew something had to be done. There wasn't the need to discuss it or figure it out or have a committee. It was like, what has to be done and what piece do I do? And then you just give them what to do and then they get to do it in their creative way. What it was like to say, let's go to Iraq. Somebody has to be there. The inspectors are leaving. And that people just the next day said yes, including Diane, said, oh, okay. What it was like to be in Iraq with Diane, who is that silence that she talks about, that can sit and watch and see and profoundly say what's present. And when I remember when we were in Babylon and we walked through what had been the cradle of civilization, watching what could be the grave of civilization and how quickly Diane could see that. I just want to say, There's a woman who wrote us very upset that her son has to go to Iraq. And she said that she wanted to pour gasoline on herself and light a match. That's the feeling that I think we all feel that place inside of us of despair of what do? And it was like we were able to turn that around for her into an action that would be much more powerful. So instead of despair, it's time to just take the freshness of pink and find a way that you can turn around what in the front of you is just feels impossible and turn it on its head and inspire not only yourself, but everyone around you. And we really need to do this for each one next to us, but also for the young women and men that are growing up right now.
That was activist Jody Evans of Code Pink, Women for Peace. We'll have more Unreasonable Women for the Earth in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Next, we hear from Charlotte Brody, a registered nurse, longtime activist, and mother of two. Charlotte is also the founder and director of the Healthcare Without Harm campaign, an international coalition of more than 400 organizations working to make healthcare more environmentally responsible.
Unreasonable women are motivated by a great desire for reason, and that we are unreasonable in the face of horrible unreasonableness, where being unreasonable is the only reasonable answer. I want to talk about the unreasonableness that I work on, not because it's the most horrible of the unreasonableness, but it's the piece of it that I face each day. It is horribly unreasonable that all of us, all of our bodies, and all of our breast milk is contaminated with toxic chemicals, that we are all toxic waste sites, carrying the chemicals made by the chemical industry that Diane lives in. And while Diane lives in Port Arthur, Texas, where Dow makes chemicals, I've never lived in Port Arthur, Texas, and I've never used Dursban. I am one of those nutsy gardeners who still pulls all the weeds out by hand because I can't figure out, you know, another safe way to do it. And I have many days, I'm willing to admit it since we're bearing witness and we have a Pentecostal tradition here, I have wished for Roundup. I couldn't do it myself, but I have fantasized about the ability to make all those weeds disappear a little quicker than I can do it by hand. But I've never used Dursban, I've never used a pesticide, we've never let it near the office, and when I was one of the 8 people who got my body burden tested as part of the Commonweal cohort, I had more Dursban, more Dow chemical in me than anybody else that was tested. So, you know, we can't lifestyle our way out of this, right? This is about what they're doing that's unreasonable to us. In Healthcare Without Harm, the organization that I get to be part of, we work on part of that chemical body burden, and we work on finding solutions so that the healthcare industry isn't a toxic polluter adding to our ill health. And we've been able to do some pretty amazing things. When we started in 1996, there were 6,000 incinerators burning medical waste in this country. Now there are less than 500. And we've worked especially hard to make sure that those incinerators aren't dismantled and sent to other countries. We've worked to get mercury fever thermometers and mercury blood pressure devices and mercury everything out of healthcare. And we now have 1,400 hospitals and healthcare groups where things like Kaiser Permanente just count as one. committed to ending the use of mercury by 2005. And we've gotten Walmart, Kmart, CVS, Rite Aid, Albertsons, Walgreens, all to take mercury fever thermometers off their shelves and to not send those to other countries where to pollute other people, and then the mercury comes back to us and our fish. So we've worked from the heart of unreasonableness to move towards a more reasonable world. It is unreasonable that the products that we put behind our ears and we put on our heads and we roll under our arms should have cancer-causing chemicals, mutation-causing chemicals, and chemicals that cause birth defects. That is massively unreasonable. And it is unreasonable to think that the only way out of having cancer-causing, mutation-causing, birth defect-causing chemicals is that we have to insist that everybody pay a whole lot more. And the report we did last year, Not Too Pretty, that Healthcare Without Harm and Coming Clean and Women's Voices for the Earth and the Environmental Working Group did, showed that even drugstore cosmetics, even the cosmetics and, you know, and hairspray and deodorant, even the big companies, Unilever, L'Oreal, Procter & Gamble, they made products with and without phthalates. We could have bought nail polish that was phthalate-free. And that now the European Union, in its infinite wisdom, has passed the Cosmetics Directive, which orders all companies who sell products in the European Union to take out the carcinogens, the mutagens, and the reproductive toxins, the chemicals that cause birth defects. And brothers and sisters, those are the same companies that sell products here. So the next phase of this campaign that doesn't really have a name yet, I want to test a few on you, aims to demand that the global corporations that are going to have to reformulate because of our colleagues in Europe reformulate globally so we all have safer products. And we, you know, we've been working on ideas for this campaign. One was to say, because we're worth it. Another idea was to, this is a little dark, but you know the Maybelline ad, to play off on that and say, well, maybe she's born with it and maybe it's Maybelline. That's a little bad, huh? Well, help us. We need help. The one part that really, in the spirit of Code Pink, we figured out is what we want the health and beauty industry to do is to just get a makeover.
That was Charlotte Brody, founder and director of Healthcare Without Harm. In our final segment, we hear from poet, author, and teacher Dina Metzger. Dina talks about breaking down society's accepted boundaries and the importance of asking the right questions.
Being unreasonable, being irrational, not irrational, but outside of the narrow confines of rationality, and outside of the narrow confines of reasonableness. Because whether you're talking about reasonable or unreasonable, you are talking about a mindset that is connected with a brutal and savage so-called civilization based upon ideas that come to us from the Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian, Muslim tradition, and that has brought us to this terrible place where we are now. So my first question is, how do we get out of this mind which has occupied us? How do we get out of this colonized mind? This mind has colonized the planet, and we have to change all our points of view. So there are 1,000 stories that I could tell you about what my work was and what my work is at the moment. I don't know how to do this in this period of time, so the only thing I can really do is to ask you some questions. And what I'm going to try to do is ask you some of the questions that I have been asking all my life. And to say that for a writer, I think we know that A work of literature has a question at its core. It does not have an answer. It has a question, or several questions. And actually, that what it means to be an artist is that fate has given you a question or a series of questions. You kind of know it when you're 3 years old. And then you keep asking this question again and again and again and again, not because you're a dummy, but because that's the question that has to be asked. And you really hope that by the time you die, you have addressed that question in enough ways and deeply enough so that there is some vision that can come from addressing that question. When I was 9, it was 1945. And the question that was in my mind was, how could the Holocaust have happened, and how could my country have dropped an atom bomb? And you know what? If I based my entire life, which I did, on that question, that would be sufficient. Because that is the unanswerable, unfathomable question that we have to keep asking. And it's a woman's question. It's a man's question, but it's also a woman's question. And I asked it from a woman's point of view, as a man must ask it from a man's point of view. And we must stand behind those questions. One of the things we've done is in my community is that we've created something called Dare. Dare is based on a Shona model. It's a healing community where we return healing to the center of the community where it belongs. In Dare, we sit in council. And sitting in council means that we address a question together. We sit with a question for a very, very long time, and we count on everybody's story answering and addressing that question. So here are Dare questions that I want to leave you with. What is healing really? What does it mean to be a healing presence in the world? What does it mean to be a peacemaker? Can you carry peacemaking spirits? Can you do everything you have to do to save the world?
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Stephanie Welch and the Bioneers Conference. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a cassette or CD copy of this program, number 4604, Unreasonable Women in Unreasonable Times, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck associate producer, Marguerite Judson development director, Brishan McKee office manager, Dory Taylor distribution and outreach coordinator, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and production director, Amy Pomerleau.